Psychologists don't understand what the Buddha has understood. So this is very important to understand. And something very important is that according to the Buddha's way of describing this, there are no two things called body and mind. I don't have the time to go into a detailed discussion of this. Maybe in some future time I can discuss this in more detail. But the important thing is that during, to explain this, I have to bring some history of Western philosophy into this. There was a time in England, there were three philosophers in England. Really, one was from England, the other one was from Scotland, and the other one was from Ireland. There are these three countries, really, England, Scotland and Ireland. These three philosophers came from these three places. The first man was Locke. John Locke. He pointed out that there is no such thing as a mind. He said there is only the body. The body, the brain and the nervous system. And there is no such thing as mind. And some of the modern scientists also say that. There is no such thing as a mind. There is only the brain and the nervous system, and the working, the activity of the brain and the nervous system is what is called the mind. And now, this was what he said, but there was another man called Berkeley. Berkeley didn't like this. He was a bishop. He was a Christian. And he didn't like this idea because they were believing in a thing called a soul, you see. So, but anyway, he brought out an argument and said, no, you are wrong. He said, what you are saying is there is only matter in the world, matter, which comes in the form of solids and liquids and gases. There is only matter, you are saying. But what is matter? How do you know that there is matter? Because you have seen it, you have felt it with your hands, or you have heard the sound of it, or you have got the smell of it, or you have got the taste of it. Through your senses, you have understood that there is a thing called matter. And whatever is seen through the senses is an image in your mind. It's an idea in your mind. So after all, there is no such thing as matter. There is only the mind. So he brought out this theory that there is no such thing as matter, there is only mind. That was called idealism. The earlier concept was called materialism. Materialism and idealism. Materialism said there is no such thing as mind, there is only matter. And this idealism says there is only an idea in the mind. Matter is simply an idea in the mind. There is no such thing as a matter. So who is right? If you say Berkeley was right, then Locke is wrong. If you say Locke is right, then Berkeley is wrong. So there was this problem to decide who is right. Then came this third man, Hume, and he said, you are both wrong, but partly correct. At least one person proved that there was no such thing as a mind. and the other person proved that there is no such thing as matter. And he said, that way you are both correct. There is no matter, there is no mind, there is only sense experience. In other words, there is seeing, there is hearing, there is smelling, there is tasting, there is touching, and there is thinking. That is all that we can talk about. Matter is simply a concept, mind is also just a concept. There is only sense experience. Now this way of thinking is what is today called phenomenology. And this is the position that the Buddha also took. There is a sutra where the Buddha says, this is the all, the eye and what is seen, the ear and what is heard, the nose and what is smelled, the tongue and what is tasted, and the thinking and what is thought about. Now this means to talk about a thing called matter is also not correct. To talk about a thing called mind is also not correct. Now, to go into a more detailed discussion of this, I'll have to go deep into the philosophy. But for the time being, we'll accept that. And then the important thing to understand is the Buddha doesn't speak about two things called body and mind. But the Buddha used two words, nama and rupa. And today people translate that as body and mind, which is incorrect. Nama and rupa is not body and mind. Rupa is simply the mental image. Now means in the Sinhalese language also we have rupa. Rupa is a picture, a mental image. That's what the rupa is. And nama is simply the name. We have mental images and we give names to these mental images. And we identify things. It's the identity. The mental image and the identity. And the identity itself is a concept. A concept is actually given in the form of a sentence. So it is, because of that, it is called verbal. So whenever we think, we are thinking in two ways, in the form of a mental picture, and in the form of words. Now if you think, I want to go home, a mental picture of the home will come into your mind. And I want to go home means it's a sentence. And that is all that we can talk about. The Buddha says, it is only the nama and the rupa that we can talk about. That is the meaning of nama and rupa. So, but when we speak about the mind, the Buddha used these three words, chitta, mano and vijnana. And what is vijnana? To understand this, we have to again use a modern concept. And that is, we have to use this word called organism. Organism. What is an organism? An organism is something like a machine. Now, a living organism is a living machine. Now, if we take what is called a unicellular organism, like amoeba or something like that, it's a small, tiny animal which is only one cell. I hope you know what a cell is. If you have studied science or something like that, you will know what a cell is. So I assume that you know it, because if I go to explain that, it will take a long time. But the important thing is that any organism is called an organism because it is like a machine, active. And we are, as human beings also, our whole body is an organism, works like a machine. Now breathing is an activity of this organism. Eating is an activity. And when food enters the mouth, it goes through the intestines and you get what is called digestion and assimilation and things like that. All that is working like a machine. Even the heart beating is like a machine. And we have a thing called the nervous system and the brain. All this is working like a machine. Now, this organism, as the human organism, is reacting to stimulation. That means our senses are stimulated by the environment. That means light falling on the eye stimulates the eye, and so there is a reaction. And the reaction is seen. When sounds come to the ears, that is stimulation of the ear, and the reaction is to hear something. So like that, it is the organism reacting to stimulation. So the reaction is what we call the mind. This is the important thing to understand. So the reaction also, the first part of the reaction is what is called perception. That means seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching is what is called perception. That is the first part. And that is what is called vijnana. It's called chakhu vijnana, which means seeing. Sota vijnana means hearing, gana vijnana means smelling, jivha vijnana means tasting, kaya vijnana means touching. And so vijnana is simply perception. Today it is translated as consciousness, which is not the correct translation. Long time ago, some British people came and studied some of these teachings of the Buddha, and they did their own translation. And now today, all the Buddhists are just blindly following those translations. And by doing that, they have misunderstood the teachings of the Buddha, because the translations are not accurate. So it is very important to get the proper words to translate these things. So what we call vijnana is perception. Eye perception, ear perception, nose perception, tongue perception, body perception. That is perception. That means seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. And then comes the thinking part. The thinking is not the sensory activity. Thinking is the activity of the brain. Brain, there is what is called the cerebrum. And the cerebral cortex is the external part of the brain. And that is what is doing the thinking part, cerebral cortex, activity of the cerebral cortex. Now that is what is called the mano. Mano is the activity of the brain. There. The thinking, reasoning. What is called the intellect or the intelligence itself is all the activity of the brain. mano. So the sensory activity is the vijnana, and the activity of the brain is the mano. Now what happens is, when we open our eyes and see something, and then we begin to interpret what we see. Now the interpretation is done by the mano part. Now once we have interpreted, oh, say for example, a young man seeing a sexy looking girl or something like that will be aroused. There is sexual arousal. How does that happen? A message goes from the brain to a gland, what are called the sexual glands. And the gland secretes a hormone into the blood. And the blood carries the hormone to various parts of the body. And different parts of the body become activated. Some parts become overactivated, some parts become underactivated, and so a change takes place in the whole body. And that whole change in the body is what is called an emotional arousal. In the same way, if you become angry, what does that mean? Say you see a person doing something and you become angry. You see it, that is the perceptual part, and then you interpret what has been seen, that is the conceptual part, which is the mano part, and then the message goes to the gland, the adrenal gland, and adrenaline hormone is secreted, and then you get the anger aroused, which means change take place in the body. Now, that emotional arousal, that part is what is called chitta. Now, this is why the Abhidharma scholars say the chitta is in the blood. That is true. Chitta is in the blood, but not mano. Mano is the activity of the brain. And vijnana is the activity of the senses. So these are three words that the Buddha used, chitta, mano and vijnana, referring to the activity of the body. So when we speak about the emotion, it is simply the activity of the whole body there. And then this activity of the body, which is the emotional arousal, what does that do? The emotional arousal, whether it is a desire or whether it is a hatred or whether it is a fear, tension arises in the body. The muscles become tensed. Even in Sinhalese we say tadaveno. Tadaveno means muscle become tense. Huh? So the muscles become tense means, what does that mean? It makes us uncomfortable. And so we try to get rid of the discomfort. How do we get rid of the discomfort? By releasing the tension in action. The action can come in the form of bad words, if you are angry. And it can lead to fighting, quarreling. Now that is the action, that is the release of tension. So the action is the release of tension. Now if you have been going to learn about stress and stress management, these people talk about these things. And this is what is called stress. What is stress? The important problem about stress is that today, when we become angry, we can't release the tension in action. You become angry with your boss, if you go to release the tension, you'll be out. So you can't. When you come home, you might fight with your wife or your husband, or maybe your children or your neighbors, but that doesn't solve the problem. You see, the important thing is the tension cannot be released. And if the tension is not released, the tension remains. And that is creating the problem. That is the meaning of stress. Now, this is what the Buddha called dukkha. Yampi chang nalabati tampi dukkhan. What does that mean? The inability to satisfy your desires is dukkha. That means the inability to release the tension. That means the whole reaction of the organism to environmental stimulation. That whole reaction is first the vijnana, then comes the mano, and then comes the citta, and the citta leads to the action, cetana. The cetana part is how the emotion leads to the release of tension and action. This is why the Buddha said, cetana aham bhikkave kammang vadami. What is called karma is cetana. So it is this emotional arousal that what we call lobha and dosa and moha. So the lobha, dosa and moha is the root of karma. So this is why when we are able to gain control over our emotions, that is called good karma. When we begin to release the tension in action, that becomes bad karma. So when we speak about the five precepts, what are we talking about? It is learning not to release the tension in action. But if you don't release the tension in action, what happens? The tension remains. This is why Freud wrote a book called Civilization and Its Discontents. To be civilized is to not to release the tension in action, not to go and fight and quarrel and do all kinds of mischief. That is to be civilized. And the moment you become civilized, your tensions remain. And then you have the problem of stress. And you have to go after stress management. So this is what Freud pointed out. Now the Buddha saw this. This is why the Panchasila is not the end. That is only the beginning. You can control your behavior by observing the five precepts. But the tension remains. You have to learn how to get rid of the tension. And the Buddha pointed the way to get rid of the tension, not by release of tension in action, but there is another way. That is what is called conscious relaxation, which today the stress management people try to teach. Because this whole reaction, which is coming in the form of the vijnana, which is the perception, and even conception, where we begin to interpret what we see, and the emotional arousal itself, all that is happening unconsciously. We are not doing anything. It is happening to us. When you become angry, you don't think, I must now become angry and then I become angry. No. Anger arises even without your knowledge. And you don't know how to get rid of it. So these are all things happening unconsciously. But if you can become conscious of this, it is only by becoming conscious of this that you are able to gain control over this. And becoming conscious is what is called sati, satipatthana, if you have heard that word. Sati means you have to become aware of this. And it is through this awareness that you gain control over these emotional impulses, sati. And by becoming aware of the tension, you learn to relax the tension. When you become angry, if you can watch, here I am getting angry, now my muscles are becoming tensed, and my breathing is also changing, and then you can calm down your breathing, relax your body consciously, and the anger disappears. So this is how the Buddha pointed out. So this part of the game comes in the form of meditation. So this is why it is not enough to practice the five precepts. We also must learn to meditate. And the best meditation is metta bhavana. Not just anapanasati. Anapanasati is okay if it is done in the proper way. But most people think anapanasati is an exercise in concentration. This is not an exercise in concentration. It is an exercise in relaxation. And also, when we think of metta bhavana, may all beings be well and happy, that thought, when properly cultivated, will end the anger. Why? There again, if you study some anatomy and physiology, you will understand that there is a part of the nervous system which is called the autonomic nervous system. And there are two pathways. One is called the sympathetic and the other is called the parasympathetic. So messages go through the sympathetic to the adrenal gland and then adrenaline is poured into the blood. And that is how you become angry or even fears and worries, anxieties, all that comes from that. But when you think, may all beings be well and happy, what happens? Messages go from the brain in the parasympathetic pathway. And when that happens, the whole body comes to normal. The blood gets purified. So this is the power of the metta bhavana. So it is very important, especially in the lay life, to practice the metta bhavana. May all beings be well and happy. That thought, when cultivated, becomes very powerful in overcoming anger. We begin to, when we think of metta, which means our mind extends or expands outwards, we become interested not only in ourselves, we become interested in all beings. Normally people are narrow-minded. When we practice metta bhavana, we become broad-minded. And the broad mind helps us to overcome all these problems in life. When you go to the office, you might find bad people. When you are at home also, you might find bad people. Children growing up find they begin to quarrel with brothers and sisters. All this is, people begin to quarrel with neighbors. Why? Because their minds are narrow. They are thinking only about themselves. They are not thinking about the other people. So, when we begin to think of the others, that others have problems just as I have problems. So, if the other person behaves in a bad way, it may be because that person has some worries going on in the mind. So you begin to sympathize, and that sympathy helps you to overcome your anger. So if you begin to practice the metta bhavana, which means to think of all beings, not only myself, may all beings be well and happy, then we become happy ourselves. Because happiness is not something that we get by stimulating the senses. Happiness is a state of the mind. The mind that is free of these emotional agitations. The mind that is calm, tranquil. That is the happy mind. It is the pure mind that is happy. When the mind is purified, it is happy. So I hope I have spoken enough today, and I hope you understood what I said, and you should go home and think about this, and this will be of great benefit to you in this life itself. Now, Buddhists have this custom of thinking that all these merits are for the next life. This is not true. Buddhism means mainly to think about this life, not to be thinking of the next life. If your mind is purified here and now, you'll be happy here and now. And if you are happy here and now, you'll be happy in the next life also. So the important thing is to purify the mind here and now. So I hope you understood, and I wish you all good health, happiness.